The role I thought I would play, I will not be talking about specific cases from the most recent term, but I thought I'd like to add a little bit of perspective on, at this point, what the Roberts Court, what we might make of the Roberts Court. It really is remarkable to think that when the court sits this fall, it will begin its 10th year. Ten terms of the Roberts Court, that's really quite a lot. In a sense, the Roberts Court really began in the year 2000. Now that, you'll say, wait a minute, Chief Justice John Roberts took his seat in 2005, so what are you talking about? Well, I'm talking about Bush versus Gore, that much noted and often reviled case where the court cut off the Florida recount and in effect decided the presidential contest in favor of George W. Bush. And that, of course, put Republican control on the White House so that when 2005 came and Chief Justice Justice O'Connor announced her plan to retire at the end of that term, then we started some turnover after, about 11 years, I think, in which there'd really been no turnover at all, 1994 to 2005. So in the summer of 2005, the president nominated John Roberts to fill O'Connor's seat. Now, what nobody expected to happen, least of all Chief Justice Rehnquist, was that Rehnquist died a few months later, opening up a second seat. So the president, having nominated John Roberts to fill O'Connor's seat, then shifted him over to the chief seat and then named Samuel Alito to take the other vacancy. So that by the end of that year, as the court set that fall, there were two Bush appointees on the court. Now, Roberts replacing Rehnquist didn't achieve much of an ideological shift because they were both similarly conservative. Alito was, on the other hand, rather more conservative than O'Connor, and I think that has, as we all know, made a difference. Now that Kennedy is the sort of often the fifth and decisive vote, he is certainly to the right in general, with some important exceptions, of Justice O'Connor. So the court has tilted somewhat to the right. We do have two Obama nominees sitting on the court, Justices Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, but they by and large have not shifted the balance either. So after that beginning, what do we have? I mean, I'm not going to walk you term by term through what the court has done in these 9 years, almost 10 years now, but there are some cases, if one supposed that judicial activism was the preserve of justices on the court's left wing, the Roberts Court has proved them wrong. There are certainly examples of what one is bound to call self-confidence, judicial activism, bold conservatism on the court's part. One or two examples will be familiar to you. In 2008, the court decided in D.C. versus Heller, the Second Amendment case, that the right to bear arms is an individual right, not a collective right, thus overturning long-standing conventional wisdom about the Second Amendment. More recently, Citizens United surely has to be one of the landmark cases of the Roberts Court, 2012, where the court decided that the First Amendment protects independent political expenditures by corporations, a case which obviously plowed some new ground in that arena. Among the other important Roberts Court opinions, the Affordable Care Act case, Sebelius, 2012. And these cases, by the way, are pretty much 5-4 cases. They show the court's close divisions. In Sebelius, of course, the court did uphold the individual mandate, but did so under the taxing power, what I think has more long-term significance in the Affordable Care Act case is what five justices have told us about the Commerce Clause, placing some fairly significant limitations on that power, and what a majority of the justices have told us about the spending power. Spending power cases have been fairly rare in the Supreme Court, and one thought perhaps that wasn't much of a limitation on congressional power, and after the Affordable Care Act case, we know that's not true. One other case, which I think may be the most activist of them all, it certainly is one that I think is pretty remarkable. Last year's Shelby County case, where after decades of deferring to Congress on the meaning of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the court struck down the one section of that of that particular statute, the coverage, so-called coverage formula. They did leave open the pre-clearance requirement, but it has no meaning unless coupled with an effective coverage formula. Now, it's unimaginable that the court in the, say, in the 60s or 70s, the Warren Court and its successors, it's unimaginable that court in that era would have breathed down Congress's neck the way the court did in Shelby County. This is a sea change, I think, in the relationship between the court and Congress. Now, if I stopped right there, I'd be painting a very conservative picture of an activist court that was actually imposing some new mandates on the Constitution. But you have, on the other hand, some fairly remarkable cases that point in another direction. Just to give you a couple of examples, if you look at the court's Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment decisions, you find that the court in some quite recent cases has used the Eighth Amendment to increasingly curtail the state's power to impose the death penalty as being cruel and unusual. In 2008, for example, Kennedy versus Louisiana, the court said that the Eighth Amendment does not permit a state to impose the death penalty for rape of a child. It had been thought that states had that power. Now we know that they don't. In another case, Miller versus Alabama, the court has struck down states imposing mandatory life sentences without possibility of parole for juvenile offenders. And one other example of the cases that tend to point away from any facile and easy generalization about a conservative court, last year's much-noted decision in United States versus Windsor. The DOMA case, where the court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act as a curious kind of bifurcated opinion using federalism and notions of personhood or human dignity all wrapped together, which we will find out, I suppose, in the term that's about to begin, just how much further the court is willing to go in this area. But that's one of those cases that reminds us of the critical part that Justice Kennedy plays in where the court is now. So it's not an easy picture. You can't sort of just sum this court up in a few words. There's enough going on to suggest this is not your grandfather's Warren Court. This is a different tribunal. It is, in many areas, the Commerce Clause and Church and State and some others, to the right of where the court would have been 30 or 40 years ago. But there are enough counterexamples. I just gave two or three of them, enough counterexamples to make you hesitate before you make easy generalizations. Well, it's clear that a handful of cases can't tell the whole story. One term of court doesn't tell the whole story. It never does. It's in many ways a function of whatever happens to be on the docket of the court that particular term. But looking at the court through the lens of individual cases is a very useful way of thinking about the Roberts Court, its constitutional interpretations, and its jurisprudence generally. So that's what we propose to do this afternoon with selected cases from the 2013-2014 term. And I think you're in for a treat to hear from my three colleagues. So if I may, I'll turn to Barb Armacost.
So my task is to address the Roberts Court's Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. In this area, one of the most important issues involves the application of the Fourth Amendment to the use of sophisticated surveillance technology by police officers. In addition to Riley versus California, this term's case about the cell phone, about searching the cell phone, the Roberts Court has addressed the use of GPS technology and also the use of a trained narcotics dog to search for drugs. And those cases give us some insight in the direction of the Roberts Court. Waiting in the wings is a whole range of technologies that are already in current use by police, including the use of surveillance drones, robotic cameras, gunshot detection systems known as GDS, GPS-equipped darts, facial recognition and iris scanning devices, X-ray vans, which I hadn't heard of, and monitoring of online internet data, to name just a few that the police are already using. As of now, the court has not granted cert in any of these cases, involving these new technologies, but they're undoubtedly in the court's rearview mirror as they decide Fourth Amendment cases. So let me set the stage a bit by telling you a little bit about how the Supreme Court has traditionally handled the use of technology by police. As you'll see, the Supreme Court's earlier forays into the Fourth Amendment regulation of surveillance technology seem almost quaint now. So let me give you a couple of examples. So early on, the court reviewed each of two cases in which police had concealed a radio-controlled beeper into a drum containing a precursor chemical used to make methamphetamine. And then in each of these cases, police used beeper and visual surveillance to follow the vehicle containing the drum to the methamphetamine lab. The court held that the beeper surveillance was not a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment because police had seen the drum be put into the vehicle, and then the vehicle was simply observed on public streets. In other words, the defendant had exposed his movements to the public. And the court reasoned, what the public can see, the cops can see. In two later cases, the court considered whether the use of airplanes and helicopters hovering over the defendant's marijuana field or greenhouse violated the Fourth Amendment. And similar to the beeper cases, the court held that because the public can and does look down from airplanes and helicopters on your property, the overhead surveillance was not a search. Again, what the public can see, the cops can see. And then more recently, the court considered, again, this is pre-Roberts Court, whether the use of an infrared camera to photograph the outside of a house violated the Fourth Amendment. The photograph revealed a hot spot on the garage where the police believed the suspect was growing marijuana. Unlike in the beeper and overflight cases, here the court said that the photograph was a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, in part because the photograph revealed information about the inside of a house. The court went on to say, though, that its rule applied only until the particular technology at issue was not in public use. Once a surveillance technology is in public use, presumably we're back to the rule, what the cops can see, what the public can see, the cops can see. So this test for analyzing evolving surveillance technology has two obvious weaknesses. First, it defines the scope of police investigation by asking what are our expectations vis-a-vis one another, even though police looking and listening is much more intrusive than the looking and listening the public does. And secondly, the test means that privacy protection in connection with technological innovations is always shrinking because as these innovations become accessible to the public. So that was the state of the law in this area when the Roberts Court took over. And the court has considered two cases involving surveillance technology. The first was Florida versus Jardines, in which the court held that a drug sniff of the front door of a house by a trained dog is a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment and thus required probable cause and a warrant. I include this case as a case about technology because Justice Kagan, in her concurrence, joined by Ginsburg and Sotomayor, noted that a trained dog is a super sensitive instrument that can detect things that are not accessible to the human nose. And so then applying Kylo, the infrared photograph case, Kagan reasoned that police had used a device not in public use to explore details of the house, which meant it was a search under the Fourth Amendment. Second, in United States versus Jones, the court held that placing a GPS unit on the bottom of the suspect's vehicle and tracking his movements over a four-week period was a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, that thus such surveillance requires probable cause and a warrant. A majority of five justices decided the case on the very narrow ground that the GPS unit was placed on the bottom of the car, and that was a trespass into a constitutionally protected space. One of this five and four others, though, reached the broader question of whether this kind of extensive surveillance, even without a trespass, would violate the Fourth Amendment. Five justices said it would. As the concurring justices noted, unlike visual surveillance or beeper technology, GPS technology allows police to track public movements over long periods of time with very little expenditure of public resources. So, in Justice Sotomayor's words, quote, GPS monitoring generates a precise, comprehensive record of a person's public movements that reflects a wealth of detail about her familial, political, professional, religious, and sexual associations. The government can store such records and efficiently mine them for information years in the future. And because GPS monitoring is cheap in comparison to conventional surveillance techniques, and by design proceeds surreptitiously, it evades the ordinary checks that constrain abusive law enforcement. In Jones, then, the Roberts Court began to acknowledge that the old privacy tests dealing with technology that only slightly enhanced the normal senses, helicopter hovering, beepers, and infrared, was not entirely adequate for analyzing modern sophisticated surveillance techniques, and Riley picks up where Jones left off. So let me talk about Riley. So in Riley, the Supreme Court reviewed two consolidated cases that raised a common question: whether the police may, without a warrant, search digital information on a cell phone seized from an individual who's been arrested. In each of these two cases, the defendant had been arrested and immediately searched incident to arrest. During the search incident to arrest of their persons, the suspect's cell phones were seized. In the first case, police officers went through the defendant Riley's cell phone and found emails and photographs that connected him with gang activity and particularly with the shooting. Riley was charged with three counts: firing at an occupied vehicle, assault with a semi-automatic weapon, and attempted murder. Prior to trial, he sought to suppress all the information that had been obtained from his cell phone, and the motion was denied. The evidence was admitted, and Riley was convicted on all three counts. In the second case, defendant Worry was arrested after police observed him participating in a drug sale from his car. During a search incident to arrest, the police seized two cell phones. Soon after, the officers noticed that one of the cell phones was repeatedly receiving calls from a number identified as My House. Police opened the phone and eventually used an online phone directory to trace the number to the apartment where Worry resided. They then obtained a warrant to search the apartment, and they seized a bunch of crack cocaine, marijuana, drug paraphernalia, firearm, and ammunition. And Worry was charged with possessing crack cocaine and with intent to distribute and being a felon in possession of a firearm. He moved to suppress the evidence from the search of his apartment because he said it was the fruit of the illegal search of his cell phone. The district court denied the motion, Worry was convicted, and then the First Circuit reversed the denial of Worry's motion to suppress and vacated Worry's conviction. The Supreme Court then granted cert in each of these two cases and consolidated them for argument. In an opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, and joined by seven other justices, the Supreme Court reversed Riley's conviction and affirmed the reversal of Worry's conviction. The court held that police must obtain a warrant to search a cell phone, even if it's seized pursuant to a search incident to arrest. Thus, the evidence supporting both convictions had to be excluded. The judgment was unanimous. Justice Alito wrote a separate opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment, but the judgment itself was unanimous. So let me give you a little background on the case law the Supreme Court actually applied in Riley. So the court has held that a person who's arrested is subject to a search incident to arrest of his person and his grabbing area. And the justification for a search incident to arrest is twofold. First, the search incident to arrest is designed to protect the officer himself by allowing him to remove any weapons that could be used against the officer. And secondly, to prevent the arrestee from destroying any evidence that the defendant might have on her person or within her reach. The scope of the search incident to arrest, importantly, includes opening any containers or bags the police might find in the suspect's pockets or within the arrestee's grabbing area. And importantly, police can open those containers and bags without making a separate showing that those bags or containers are likely to contain weapons or contraband. This makes the search incident to arrest a very powerful investigative tool. During search incidents to arrest, lower courts have permitted police to open and search diaries, ledgers, and bills, papers, address books, wallets, notebooks, checkbooks, purses, and suitcases, as long as they were located within the arrestee's grabbing distance. In support of its holding in Riley, the Supreme Court made two main arguments. First, the court held that the search of the cell phone was not supported by either of the justifications for the search incident to arrest: officer safety and the risk that evidence might be destroyed. As to the first, digital data is obviously not going to be used by the arrestee to harm the officer. In this way, cell phones are different from physical containers, which are removed from the suspect's person. Even a tiny container could conceivably contain a razor blade or a small knife. The government tried to argue that searches of cell phones might assist officer safety in more indirect ways, for example, by alerting police that the suspect's Confederates are headed for the scene, but the government provided no concrete evidence for that argument, and the court concluded that where such circumstances would arise, they could be handled on a case-by-case basis. As to the second rationale, to prevent the defendant from destroying evidence, the government argued cell phone data may be vulnerable in two ways, either because there can be remote wiping of data or the data could be encrypted. So remote wiping occurs when a phone connected to a wireless network receives a signal that just erases the stored data. Encryption is a security feature that some modern cell phones have in addition to password protection. When such phones lock, data becomes protected by sophisticated encryption, and they're essentially unbreakable. The Supreme Court responded that the government had provided no solid evidence of these particular dangers, and in addition, it's not clear that searches could be conducted early enough to avoid these problems even without a warrant, as police will be likely taken up with arresting the suspect, securing the scene, etc. Moreover, the court noted that remote wiping can be prevented by disconnecting the phone from the network, for example, by taking the battery out of it, or by leaving it powered and storing it in an enclosure that isolates the phone from radio waves. Finally, the court suggested that if there really was a true emergency that the cell phone needed to be searched, police may be able to rely on an exigency search or quickly get a phone warrant. In its second main argument, the court responded to the government's argument that a cell phone is simply a digital form of the kinds of physical objects that could be found in an arrestee's pockets. And remember, I said arrestee's pockets can be emptied and everything can be searched. It's well established the search incident to arrest can include all kinds of really intimate materials, such as address books, wallets, and diaries. The court has acknowledged that searches of these kinds of physical items had been justified by the reasoning that taking a person into custody already involves a substantial governmental intrusion, to which the search incident to arrest is only really a minor incidental intrusion. The Supreme Court rejected the analogy, as it should, between cell data and the personal items or containers containing information. Here, the court made a crucial distinction between physical information storing or containing objects, such as address books, wallets, and diaries on the one hand, and technologically sophisticated cell phones that contain vastly more information that could possibly fit on paper in a person's pocket or in their entire house, unless their cell phone was in the house. The court noted that cell phones differ in both qualitative and quantitative sense from other objects that might be kept in an arrestee's person. In the court's words, quote, "The term cell phone is itself misleading shorthand. Many of these devices are in fact mini computers that also happen to have the capacity to be used as a telephone. They could just as easily be called cameras, video players, Rolodexes, calendars, tape recorders, libraries, diaries, albums, televisions, maps, or newspapers. In addition, they have huge storage capacity, permitting users to carry data in their pockets that reaches back years or even decades. And finally, and importantly for the next GPS case, the court pointed out that a cell phone collects and stores many types of information that together reveal much more than any isolated record would. All this means that the sum of any individual's private life could be reconstructed from the information on their cell phone, the thousands of photographs, text messages, emails, search records, documents, bank statements, etc. In sum, the privacy intrusion that occurs when cell phones are searched has no comparison with searching the pockets of arrestees for ordinary physical items. So to sum up, in Riley versus California, the Roberts Court addressed the reality that the majority in Jones put off for another day. Remember, I said Jones decided the case on a trespass basis without really addressing the search itself. Modern surveillance technology permits police to gather a quantity and quality of information that will require a fresh look at the old tests that were adequate for older technologies that were subject to natural limitations of time, space, and resources. As the court recognized in Riley, the search of a cell phone is different by many orders of magnitude than a search of any other physical object that could be pulled from the suspect's pocket.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming. I'm delighted by the turnout, and I'm sure it's attributable to your intense interest in the Supreme Court. But perhaps the gloomy weather and free food is helping, too. So my job today is to talk to you about McCutcheon versus FEC. It's the latest in a string of explosive cases from the Roberts Court on campaign finance, and it's a great case. It involves complex First Amendment doctrine. It involves important public policy issues. It features a sharp 5-4 split among the justices. And more coarsely, it pits the conservatives against the liberals. It involves shrill cries of political corruption. And my favorite feature of Supreme Court opinions, there are many confident assertions of fact that are self-evidently wrong. So let me start with just a little bit of background, and then we'll get into the facts of the case. So there are many ways to participate in politics, to spend money in politics lawfully in the United States. One of the principal ways is through campaign contributions. So this is giving money directly to a candidate's campaign. So just to be crystal clear about this with an example, if back in the fall of 2012, you pulled out your credit card and jumped online and gave $100 to Mitt Romney's campaign or Barack Obama's, you made a campaign contribution. Now, for decades, Congress has, in various ways at various times, limited campaign contributions. It has said, it's passed statute saying, you can give some, but only some, to candidates running for office. Now, why might that be? Straightforwardly, there's a concern about corruption. You don't have to be too cynical to think if one individual can hand $1 million to a candidate for office and that candidate wins, that person might feel a certain debt to their benefactor. At some point, they might set public interest on the shelf and engage in a favor that benefits that wealthy person at the expense of society. So we have these concerns about corruption. They seem perfectly reasonable, and these have motivated the Congress's decision to put a cap on contributions. Okay, there's just one problem, and it's the pesky First Amendment. Campaign contributions, according to the Supreme Court anyway, are more than just money spent on politics. They're acts of political speech. They're acts of political expression. They're also, critically to these opinions, they're acts of political association. So here's the idea. I want to associate as an individual voter with a particular candidate who's running for office. And I want to associate with that person's political party. And one of the principal means by which I can do this is by handing them money. So if you limit how much I can contribute to them, you are stamping on my associational rights. So here's the fundamental conflict. On the one hand, we have sensible policy reasons to think we ought to put an upper limit on contributions. Nobody likes corruption. On the other hand, we have these First Amendment values that are suggesting this is a problem. So in general, there are some exceptions, including McCutcheon. It had been the case that the Supreme Court navigated this trade-off, this conflict, by saying, well, contribution limits are okay, they're constitutional, as long as they aren't too low. Right? If you can only give $10, that's probably not enough. But if you can give an amount quite a lot higher than that, we won't worry about it. Okay, now, just a little bit more background. There are two kinds of contributions and limits on those that we need to distinguish. So the first is called a base limit, and the second is called an aggregate limit. So the idea of a base contribution limit is this. You can only give so much to any given person or entity. So the limits right now in federal elections for a single two-year election cycle is $5,200. So Senator X is running for re-election. I can give up to $2,600 to his campaign for the primary election. I can give up to another $2,600 for the general. That's a total of $5,200. And I can't give another cent to Senator X. I can give money to others, but I can't give him or her any more. And likewise, we have base limits on political action committees, not super PACs. That's separate. If you're keenly interested, you can take my class. But the traditional political action committees, you can only give up to $5,000 in any two-year election cycle to a political action committee. Those are all base limits. Then we also have this thing called an aggregate limit. And it's just an umbrella. It's just about the total amount of money you can spend in any two-year election. So prior to McCutcheon, that aggregate limit for contributions to candidates was about $50,000. So here was the idea. You could give up to $5,200 to this guy, and another $5,200 to that candidate, and so forth and so on, until you had spent about $50,000. And then you're done. You can't give any more, not a single cent to any other candidate. So that's the aggregate limit for contributions to candidates. Then there's an aggregate limit for contributions to PACs. You can give $5,000 to this one and that one and so forth until you've hit this upper limit, and then you're done. So prior to McCutcheon, the total amount you could give to all these different parties and PACs and candidates was about $125,000. Okay, so it's this second kind of contribution limit, the aggregate limit, that was at issue in the McCutcheon case. So Sean McCutcheon is a wealthy businessman living in Alabama. He passionately supports conservative causes. And he, in the last election cycle, gave some money to the first candidate he supported and gave some money to the second and so forth and so on. He only got through about a dozen candidates, and he'd hit that upper limit. The federal statute said you can't give any more. Well, he was not satisfied. He wanted to give more to more candidates, and he's sort of a symbolic and patriotic figure. He wanted to give $1,776 to a whole bunch of candidates. And this aggregate limit stood in his way. So he challenged it in federal court, and he claimed the aggregate limit violates the First Amendment. Now, how can this be? The aggregate limit that I've been telling you about has been in place for decades. And in the 1970s, in a case called Buckley, it's a critical case, the Supreme Court said that aggregate limit is constitutional. So on what basis? Well, let's talk about that first. Why is that constitutional? Back in Buckley, the Supreme Court said we can justify this aggregate limit because of concerns about circumvention. So here's the idea. I could give $5,200 to this candidate, and that hits the base max, right? Or alternatively, I could just set up 10 PACs. Maybe I'll set up 100 PACs, and I'll give every one of them $5,000, and all 10 or 100 of those PACs will channel all that money to one candidate. So I could either contribute directly $5,200, maybe I'll do that anyway, but I can also indirectly circumvent that limit and convey $500,000 to that candidate. So that was the idea. Congress was concerned about people circumventing the base limits, and so they put this overall cap. You can do this move, you can do that one, you can set up PACs and shell corporations or whatever else, but the aggregate limit at some point is going to stop you. You can only convey so much money to one candidate for office. So the circumvention concerns justified this aggregate limit in the 1970s. What about today? Well, things have changed. Or they've changed according to five of the justices on the Supreme Court. They said the circumvention concerns are gone. And then, this is the part of the opinion that I won't get into details on, because it's only very interesting to election law junkies. They proceed to go step by step through a series of reasonably complex FEC regulations that purport to have plugged all these loopholes. So back in the 1970s, there really was nothing directly in your way with respect to these 10 PACs or 100 PACs. You really could set them all up, or try to, and have them all channel money to a candidate. But the Supreme Court points to a regulation that now exists that forbids that kind of thing. And you can imagine other ways of circumventing. So instead of setting up all these PACs, what I do is give $5,200 to 10 candidates, and then I go and tell all of them, listen, you all have to re-contribute that money. You're just a pass-through. You all give it to this other candidate, the 11th one. So now I've given that one person $52,000. Okay, well, the majority of the court points to an FEC regulation that purports to plug that loophole. And they go on and on through all these regulations, and when they're done, they say, you can't circumvent the base limit anymore. The loopholes are closed. And so the circumvention justification falls away. Okay, that's five justices. There are four justices in dissent who see things differently. They go step by step through these same FEC regulations and explain why they do not, in fact, plug all the loopholes. And again, this is not such an interesting topic of conversation for a general audience, but if you're really interested in the details, you can read the opinion and the regulations. One thing that I think is quite interesting and that's operating in the background in this opinion is an assumption, or I should say a view of whether the relevant law for purposes of assessing loopholes is the law in books or the law in action. See, the majority's view is, well, we just read the regulations on the books, and it looks to us like those regulations plug the holes. The dissent's view, on the other hand, well, they're focused more on the law in action. So they say things, well, you know, these regulations are in place, but let's think about how these things are enforced. It turns out that technically that does plug the loophole, but the information the FEC has to gather to figure out if, you know, you're doing an end run around the base limits, what they need to know to enforce that regulation, it's too much and they can't do it. And they purport to supply some evidence suggesting that the FEC can't do it. So there's a sort of interesting abstract argument going on in the background here. When you're assessing this set of laws, do you think about the surrounding laws in a vacuum, or do you think about them in actual operation? So the bottom line in the case is that the aggregate limit is unconstitutional. It's now gone. So the base limits are still in place. You can still only give up to $5,200 in any two-year cycle to any given candidate. You can only give up to $5,000 to any particular PAC. But you don't run out after you've gotten through 10 of them. You can go to 11, to 12, and so forth. Now, on the one hand, the aggregate limit really was pretty constrictive. So in any two-year cycle, it's entirely possible for 1,000 people to be running for federal office. And if you max out, you can only give to 10 of them with that old aggregate limit in place. Well, now you can give to a whole lot more. So with respect to these First Amendment values we care about, well, this opinion has liberated them to some degree. On the other hand, there's a dark side, or potentially a dark side. We have to come back to the corruption concern. So it used to be that if you went to a big high roller fundraiser with lots and lots of candidates there, lots and lots of political action committees represented, political party committees, the absolute biggest check you could write was about $125,000, and then you're done until the next election cycle, at least with respect to contributions. Now you can show up to such an event, and your check can be about $3 million, give or take. Okay, so that number makes a lot of people nervous, and it is a lot of money. On the other hand, what the majority of the court is saying is, listen, as long as no individual in this chain is getting more than that $5,200, and we don't believe $5,200 is very corrupting, then what's the concern, right? To put that slightly differently, if we think you can safely give up to $5,200 to one person, no risk of corruption, well, you can give it to two and three and four and so forth and on up to 1,000. Okay, here's the statement of fact that I'm 100% certain is false. It can't possibly be the case that $5,200 can't buy you any corruption. It can only buy you $5,200 worth of corruption, but it can still buy you some corruption. So do you think you're going to get a member of Congress's vote on high-profile legislation like the Affordable Care Act for $5,200? Not so likely. But do you think you might be able to get your chief of staff to, on behalf of a constituent who's made a contribution to you, call up and harass the EPA a little bit about an enforcement action they're thinking about taking? That seems entirely possible to me. So what that means then is when we take away the aggregate limit, we don't increase the magnitude of any corrupt act that is executed through contributions, but we sure increase the number of them. Now, that doesn't mean the opinion is wrong as a matter of law or as a matter of policy, because at the same time that we increase the total amount of corruption, small dollar corruption, but still corruption, we're liberating all these First Amendment values that we care about. People have a right to speak. The more speech that's in the air, or so we like to think anyway, the more informed voters are, and so forth. Let me just mention one other thing, and I'll stop on this note. This opinion is consistent with the Roberts Court's approach to campaign finance and election law generally in recent years. So in 2007, there was a case called Wisconsin Right to Life. It was really the precursor to Citizens United. The court loosened campaign finance restrictions. In 2010, Citizens United came down. It's a very controversial opinion. All of a sudden, corporations and labor unions and other organizations have an unlimited First Amendment right to engage in political speech. Not contributions, a different kind of political speech. And then we had the Shelby County opinion. That's not about campaign finance, but it is about election law stuff, the right to vote. And there, once again, the Roberts Court struck down a piece of a statute. So this is all consistent with the Roberts Court's deregulatory view of campaign finance and election law generally. And depending on your views of corruption and the First Amendment, you might either celebrate or castigate all these decisions. Thanks.
So I'm supposed to tell you about Hobby Lobby and the religion cases, and that, I'm afraid, may only mean I tell you about Hobby Lobby, but we'll see. So the path to Hobby Lobby actually begins in 1990 with a case called Employment Division versus Smith, where the Supreme Court dramatically changed the existing rule about the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. It had been the case that if government regulation substantially burdened the practice of your religion, government had to justify that under a compelling interest standard. But in Smith, the court says, no, that was wrong. If the law is neutral and generally applicable, we can apply it to religion. We can even apply it to a worship service, which is what was at issue in Employment Division. And the government doesn't have to have any special justification. It's enough justification that the law applies to everybody, no exceptions for religion. It's a complicated opinion. It's ambiguous in some ways. It's not clear even today just what the scope of the Smith opinion is, but it clearly provided less protection, and it gave the government an initial response to any free exercise claim. Hey, it's neutral. It applies to everybody. It can apply to you too. And it's important to note, in light of the current lineup, it was mostly the conservatives who did it. It was a Scalia opinion for four conservatives plus Justice Stevens. And I think, you know, they viewed these free exercise claims as a form of judicial activism. And the Scalia opinion is all about how you have to balance interests, and that's not for judges to do, that's for legislatures to do. Congress did not like Employment Division versus Smith, and they passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in response, unanimously in the House, 97-3 in the Senate, to reimpose the previous free exercise clause rule as a matter of statute. It's not uncommon for civil rights statutes to go beyond the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution. This looked like one more example of that, and it said if government burdens your religion, it has to justify that burden with a compelling government interest. In City of Bernie versus Flores in 1997, the court struck down the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as applied to the states, saying, we won't get into that, but we'll never get to Hobby Lobby. But Congress didn't have the power to impose that much more protection than what the Supreme Court provided under the Constitution. Bernie is a federalism decision, and it was not unanimous, but the dissents were basically based on the view that Smith had been wrong. It was unanimous on the theory that if Smith was right, Congress couldn't fix it. So that struck down RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as applied to the states, left it in effect as applied to the federal government. And Congress's initial reaction was outrage. What do you mean we can't protect the liberties of the American people? They immediately began a series of hearings trying to decide what they could do next to protect free exercise. And it turned out that the coalition that had unanimously passed RFRA was now irretrievably broken over issues of gay rights. And the Democrats, it wasn't purely a party line vote, it wasn't as bad in the late 90s as it is today, but it was a lopsidedly party line vote. The Democrats wanted a complete carve out for any civil rights claim, no religious liberty with respect to that. The Republicans, of course, wouldn't give that, and the bill couldn't be passed. But in the course of trying to salvage it, they held 9 hearings over 3 years, and they discovered 2 things they could agree on. They could agree on zoning regulation of churches, where there's a lot of abuse, and they could agree on the religious freedom rights of prisoners, which is, you know, an odd group for Congress to want to protect, but there were plenty of abuses by prison officials. So we got the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, RLUIPA, that protects these two areas, religious land use and prisoners and mental patients, and does some incidental things, responding to some cases that have been decided in this interim between 1993 and 2000. And so one of the things that RLUIPA does is amend the definition of free exercise of religion that is protected by both of these statutes, RFRA for the federal government and RLUIPA for land use and state prisoners. And whereas RFRA had simply punted and said, the exercise of religion means exercise of religion under the First Amendment, Rallupa says exercise of religion means all exercise of religion, no mention of the First Amendment, and in response to these lower court decisions, say whether or not it's central to a religious faith and whether or not it's compelled by the religious faith. That turned out to be a point of disagreement in Hobby Lobby. So by the time of Hobby Lobby, these cases are looking rather different. Hobby Lobby got caught up in the culture wars. It's not just about religious exercise. It's also about deep disagreements over sex and over abortion and over the Affordable Care Act. So for all those reasons, it became a matter of the justices voting with their tribes. The five conservatives came down on one side, the five liberals came down on the other side, and with a good bit of exaggeration on both sides. So the Affordable Care Act says insurance plans provided by anybody, by employers or on the exchanges, have to cover preventive services for women. An agency at HHS is supposed to decide what these preventive services are. They decided this includes any contraception method approved by the FDA. That includes emergency contraception, and it includes IUDs, and religious conservatives believe that each of those can sometimes act after fertilization and therefore is a form of very early abortion. Some of the amici disputed that. The government did not dispute it. The FDA label agrees with religious conservatives on that. Hobby Lobby, which is a pretty big business, but which is owned by one family, the Greens, said we cannot comply. We cannot pay for devices that may kill innocent human beings. There was a lot of this litigation. Most of it was nonprofits making the same claim. But the for-profit litigation played out differently, and the for-profit litigation got to the Supreme Court first because the government was repeatedly amending the regulations for the nonprofits. So all those cases were unripe until the regulations finally finalized. So Hobby Lobby is the first of these cases to get to the Supreme Court. The government invested a lot of effort in arguing that for-profit corporations are simply not protected by RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That was probably a strategic mistake on their part. They were clearly protected as a matter of statutory text. It was not in legislative contemplation. This wasn't an issue in 1990 to 93. No one was thinking about this. It was very much at issue in the RLUIPA debates in 1998 to 2000, and both sides in the House agreed that for-profit corporations were covered. That was part of the reason the Democrats wanted the bill to be amended to cut them out. Ginsburg put the issue better. It's not whether corporations are persons protected by the act, but do for-profit corporations ever exercise religion? And her answer was no. That they exist only to maximize profits, which was clearly not the case in Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby sacrificed all kinds of profits in pursuit of its religious goals. Alito said, look, we protect corporations to protect individuals, you know, who have a stake in the corporation. So the question is not, does Hobby Lobby Stores, Inc. exercise religion? The question is, is the Green family put to the choice of never incorporating its business or forfeiting all the religious liberty protections if they do incorporate their business? Alito said we have entertained free exercise claims by profit-making corporations before, and Ginsburg says yes, but they never won. They're just not protected. They're just not protected by the Free Exercise Clause, and therefore they're not protected by RFRA because RFRA was said to restore the previous First Amendment test. And Alito says, well, but RLUIPA changed that. They took out the reference to the First Amendment, right? This is now a freestanding statute, and textually it covers here. I think the more substantive response would have been to say, they very rarely win. That doesn't mean they can never win. And here was a closely held corporation owned by the members of one family who all agreed on their religious commitment, and there was no doubt about their sincerity, and the abortion issue has been central to religious conservatives for a generation now. This is a case where they can win. That doesn't mean there are going to be very many. So they're covered. So then the next question is, has their religious exercise been substantially burdened? The family said, we can't pay for drugs that or devices that may cause abortions. Ginsburg said, that's just too attenuated. There's no sin happens until some employee actually takes advantage of the insurance coverage and buys one of these drugs and uses it. And maybe, she's a little fuzzy on this, maybe no sin happens until and it actually causes a very early termination of a pregnancy. That was a universal argument on the secular and liberal side of this debate. And I think it flows from a refusal to take these conservative religious beliefs seriously. You know, the left said, Hobby Lobby is simply not responsible when one of its employees does something sinful. Look at the reaction the past 3 weeks to the National Football League. People think it is responsible. And they're not even paying for Ray Rice to beat up his girlfriend, right? He's just doing it. And they're saying, you're responsible for your employees. The position of the Greens was, we are paying for this abortion-inducing drug, and we can't pay for it. Ginsburg and many others on the left analogized it to paying taxes that support government programs you disagree with. But you pay taxes into a general fund. This was a targeted benefit. The Greens would be paying for these drugs and paying for these devices. And there's no cap on coverage in the Affordable Care Act. So it's not even the case that you're paying for a menu of benefits and employees might use it for one thing or they might use it for the other thing. No matter how many benefits they've drawn from your medical insurance policy for other things, they are still entitled to the abortion-inducing drugs or devices if they choose to be. Alito didn't say much of that. What he said was, we simply cannot evaluate the merit of their religious claim. They say it's not just a sin for the employee to use these devices and drugs, it's a sin for us to pay for them. Full stop, we've got to believe them. Ginsburg said, well, we got to believe them. That's their sincere religious belief. But whether that belief has been substantially burdened is a question of law that the court has to decide for itself. And I think she's right about that. I think Alito went too far with that argument. And there will be cases where the burden is just too attenuated. And courts are going to say no. And I think, you know, courts have done too much of that. And that's one of the reasons Congress changed the definition of what counts as exercise of religion. But think about the cases where somebody says, you know, I can't pay my taxes because the government is doing these sinful things. Alito said, well, all those cases, it was a political objection. It wasn't a religious objection. That's easy enough to fix. Change your pleadings. And then he says, we can't question that. I don't think so. No, I think there's also a compelling interest in collecting taxes, and the court has clearly held that. But I think this holding that we simply can't assess your claim of substantial burden is likely to cause trouble down the road. So there's a substantial burden. Does it serve a compelling interest? The court assumed that it does. The government had a compelling interest in providing free contraception to female employees. Does the law achieve that compelling interest by the least restrictive means? And that was the government's biggest problem, because it had worked out a quite effective solution for the not-for-profits. And it's complicated, and I can't walk you through all the details, but the short version is, if you're a not-for-profit religious organization, you announce, I'm a conscientious objector, I won't pay for these drugs, and then your insurance company has to pay for them itself with segregated funds, and the government's view is the insurance company will recoup that money because contraception is a lot cheaper than pregnancy. And then there's some special provisions for third-party insurance company administrators who won't recoup it, and basically they're going to get a kickback from the government. And Alito's, so it's clumsy, but it looks like it works, and Alito's view was it does work, and that's the limit of our decision. He says female employees at Hobby Lobby will have precisely the same access to all contraceptives. This plan for the nonprofits achieves all of the government's aims. The effect on female employees is precisely zero, and our holding is very specific to these facts. Ginsburg partly ignored all that and wrote a dissent as though people were actually going to lose their access to contraceptives. She partly said the workaround won't work because women have to learn about a second insurance plan from which they can collect for contraception. Regulations require that they all be notified by the insurance company, but you know, some people probably won't figure it all out. She may be right about that. She partly said, well, the court also hedges on whether the alternative is constitutional, and They do hedge. So you may have read about Wheaton College and Little Sisters of the Poor, who are now objecting to even having to send the notices as we're conscientious objectors. Part of that is based on some extra language that I don't think the government really needs, in which on the form, when they say, we won't pay for these drugs, they also instruct their insurance company to go check this regulation and find out what their obligations are. But I find it hard to imagine that they can't be required to state their conscientious objection. But you know, Little Sisters filed a new class action yesterday, so that issue is coming down the road. Alito also floated the government paying as a less restrictive alternative. And he said, you know, if this program is really so important, how can it be the government doesn't have to spend anything on it? They're going to spend $1.3 trillion on the Affordable Care Act and a few million more for contraception. Doesn't seem like much. But Kennedy, for the fifth vote, appeared to disavow that and rested squarely on the view that no one is going to lose contraception. So that's Hobby Lobby. It is not nearly as big a deal as both sides have made it out to be, because the women will get the contraception. But it's created hysteria on the left and jubilation on the right. Efforts to amend and limit the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which of course are dead on arrival in the House. But what had once been a more or less unanimous view of an important civil liberty among the political elite has now become a deeply polarizing partisan issue. We've got Holt v. Hobbs coming up this term about a Muslim prisoner who wants to grow a beard. I'm optimistic that at least we won't get this polarization on that one, because it's not about sex and it's not about any of the culture war issues. I'm hopeful that will be 9-0. The other religion case last term, I'll give 10 seconds to. If you want to participate in government affairs or attend government meetings, you have to be willing to sit through a conservative Christian prayer service. And the court was in utter denial about the impact that will have on some of you. I'm not bitter or anything. That's Town of Greece versus Galloway.